The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. A major misunderstanding or the most disrespectful act in the history of football will get to the bottom of the disappearance of the Carabao box. If there's time, we'll also talk Kepa versus Sarri while poor old Willy Caballero puts his gloves on, takes them off again and repeats the process. So City win the first trophy of the season and United, dropping like flies, still manage to hold a toothless Liverpool. Once again, Spurs react badly to the sentence, a win today and you finally have to take them seriously in this race. Elsewhere, Leicester finally get bored of Puel. Messi breaks another record and there's some excellent VAR for Real Madrid. We'll do that and lots more on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, good morning.
Hello.
John Bruin, hello.
Hi, Max.
And bringing youth and enthusiasm, Archie Rintutt, hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
And you.
Great. G-Max says, who was angrier, Barry at the loss of his Carabao box or Sarri at being mugged off by Kepa? Jason says, bring back the Carabao box. It's football's version of the Ark of the Covenant. Barry, please do the honours.
Okay, hold on. This is probably the last time ever, I think, we're going to retire it after today. Okay.
Beautiful sound, and thank you to producer Jonathan for finding that. There could have been ructions, who knows where it would have gone, which means we can really focus on Kepa versus Sarri. Manchester City win the Carabao Cup on penalties, and Chelsea played quite well in that game, but no one's talking about that at all, Barry, are they?
No, Kepa's refusal to leave the field when Sarri wanted to substitute him is grabbing all the headlines, as you could imagine, and for me, it was a gross act of insubordination. If I was his manager, Chelsea clearly aren't going to sack a £70 million goalkeeper, even though they should. If I was his manager, he would not play for me again for the rest of the season. Then we'd have a little chat about it and see where the lie of the land was. And if my boss had a problem with me dropping him for the rest of the season, I would resign. And I think this talk of it being a misunderstanding is absolute guff, because it quite clearly wasn't a misunderstanding. If Kepa did that in the army, he'd be put in the stockade for 5 years and then given a dishonourable discharge.
I thought, John, Sarri's just absolute rage was just exceptional, wasn't it? Just, you know, marching down the tunnel. What's going through his mind? They're thinking, do I just walk out? Was he thinking, do I just walk down Wembley Way and get on the tube? You know,
go and have a cigarette, I think.
I mean, quite possibly.
Yeah. I mean, he's when Sarri departs England, which may well be imminently, what are we going to remember? We're going to remember the cigarettes and that outburst of rage at Wembley. And you're going to remember that decision. Or that decision that wasn't followed through, which was taking the goalkeeper off to bring on a goalkeeper who had made a series of saves 3 years ago for Manchester City in the League Cup final, trying to repeat history with that. And it didn't happen, and just you've got this whole farrago going on. There's a couple of things there. Firstly, Chelsea's attempts to bottle this story off. Now, I was chatting to a friend of mine who worked in let's call it political PR. And he said, this is a classic movement where everyone comes out and gives their statement and tries to put the story away. Now, it hasn't worked because, you know, you flick through the newspapers this morning, you listen to the radio, you flick on the TV. No one is buying the fact that this was just a miscommunication and, hey, guys, you know, we'll move on from this. But the one thing I would say about poor Kepa, or actually not poor Kepa, in Barry's opinion, is that if this was the plan to bring on Willy Caballero for penalties, Kepa seemed completely unaware that this might be the policy. Now, presumably, we're told that football clubs really plan stuff out and plan to the letter, and Sarri had obviously planned quite, had done a lot of preparation for that game because he completely changed his game plan. Yet that penalties strategy, which seems quite sensible, you bring on a goalkeeper who's good at, no one seems to know about that. And also, for Caballero, it said that he was kicking a ball against the wall in absolute rage around the same time that Sarri was ripping his shirt.
Yeah, well, if it was a tactical thing, it reflects terribly on Sarri, because everybody's going to know that. Tim Krul, everyone knew.
Yes, exactly.
With Holland in the World Cup, that Tim Krul was going to come on. But if it isn't, Archie, then, as Barry says, it is insubordination. You know, now every Chelsea player can just go, actually, nah, I'll just stay on.
It's never a good sign when you can see... So I was at Wembley yesterday and you could see Manchester City fans laughing, but also Chelsea fans were laughing at their own manager. Now, what does that say about your authority? Particularly because in the previous 118 minutes, Sarri had almost won it back. Not entirely, of course, because obviously there are these qualms about Jorginho, Hudson-Odoi and the like. But the way that he actually tactically boxed back against Guardiola, having lost 6-0 the other week, I thought was really impressive, because the longer that game went on, the more you were thinking, Chelsea are going to nick this on penalties here. And it was only when that decision from Kepa came that I think the tide turned back against him. How you can play him after that is difficult, because what I think, particularly after what he says about it being a misunderstanding, because him saying it being a misunderstanding now opens it up for Kepa to play the next game. Whereas if he hadn't said that, then he could have dropped him and put in Caballero at least for a game. But now he's almost tied his hands behind his back and has to play Kepa in this game against Tottenham.
So what should he have done? If Kepa's saying, I'm not coming off, he should have just forced it and forced it and forced it.
Perhaps he should have waited it out, because he just flipped out in the moment. Perhaps, well, I mean, who wouldn't flip out in the moment at that stage? But he wasn't prepared to kind of play any Western kind of wait it out situation. John Moss came over. I think from a refereeing perspective, he had no choice. He couldn't act. He just had to say, what do you want to do? But in that situation, I think you almost have to bow to the pressure. Like, what else can he do? I think you would demand a stronger captain. For a start, you would demand somebody who, unlike Cesar Azpilicueta, is going to say, the club comes first here, you need to get off.
Yeah, I mean, Azpilicueta after the game sort of absolved himself completely in a very Arsene Wenger way, saying, I didn't see it. And you're like, was he right there? I mean,
I think it shows that Azpilicueta has been at Chelsea a while, because he knows that you've got to go with the tide, and the tide's going against the manager. John Terry, of course, was one of the pundits on that, and gave a fairly well, he didn't really commit himself to too much about undermining the manager or so on. But the point was made, actually, I saw this point made, that Rudiger was getting involved and saying to Kepa, you know, get off the pitch. But that in itself shows that there are great big factions within the team. And as Archie says, this is not a great sign.
Should say, one, Eden Hazard's penalty, a pressure, you need to score it, right? Or you lose the final and Panenka it. Basically, somebody tweeted, let's just be aware, I forget who it was.
Musa Okwonga.
Yeah, it was Musa Okwonga tweeted, can we just take note of the fact, amidst all of this, that Eden Hazard just chipped a goalkeeper who was virtually on his line for a penalty. But great for Raheem Sterling as well. And we have spoken a lot about the criticism Raheem Sterling has unfairly got. Just a nice moment for him.
Yeah, fantastic. And he acknowledged it afterwards on social media. His was a brilliant penalty. And he said on Twitter, you know, no stopping that one, brackets, but it was close. And it was, and highlighted some Chelsea fan behind the goal flipping the V's at him as the ball went in. So, yeah, brilliant for him. I mean, Raheem Sterling has been unfairly criticised in the press. He does seem to get more than his fair share of abuse at various grounds around the country for no apparent reason. And it's just bizarre, because he seems like a really, really nice fella. And there are bigger, you know, people more worthy of abuse than him.
John, Archie made the point, and I think we all agree, Chelsea really acquitted themselves well in a game where, before it, everyone said, I can't see anything but City steamrolling them.
No, I thought Sarri got it right. We should say, as Archie said, for 118 minutes until it all started to go completely bonkers. But I thought he actually put the same formation, the same attacking trio, is the team that beat Manchester City back in December. Which in another game where they sat back, soaked up pressure, and that day they took their chances. But I have to say, the two players that were brilliant are the two best players for Chelsea, Eden Hazard. He did tire in extra time, but before that was magnificent, absolutely brilliant. And then Kante, if you're in a team where you've got to hustle the other team and chase them down, there is no better player. And the thing is with Kante, unlike Hazard, he did get stronger as the game went on. Absolutely fantastic performance. Unfortunately, once Hazard tied, they were lacking a little bit up front. Higuain came on and didn't do too much. The chances didn't really come for them, but they could have nicked it. And that was the plan.
I would temper it a little bit in that I don't think Chelsea had a shot on target in the entire game.
It's a minor detail.
I think Edison's first save came in the penalty shootout. I thought that you still were looking at Kante and being, why are you using the best Hoover in the world here in an attacking sense? But it still worked. I would agree with that. I thought City were a bit disappointing. I really like the look of Zinchenko at left back. I've not seen a whole lot of him, but I thought he was very impressive, particularly in terms of his attacking play. Some of these balls over the top were excellent. I thought De Bruyne was very deep as well. I wasn't sure exactly how they were going to break them down in that sense. But for Chelsea, so many positives, which are then brought down by one very selfish individual.
What do we think will happen?
As in Sarri out, or?
Well, I don't know how he's fixed financially. I'm guessing he's probably doing all right for if he's worked in banking and is a successful football manager. But I think he should resign.
No, I'm desperate for Sarri to stay because I really want to see if Sarri ball is given 3 years, will it actually work? Because we're told, because actually his record is not dissimilar to Pep's record in his first season, right, at Manchester City. So it's not as disastrous as we think it is. And I'd like to see it play out.
But this isn't about you, Max.
Okay, fair point.
And this is Chelsea.
That's also a fair point.
In terms of who comes in, though, what happened just before the weekend with that transfer ban, which looks like it will be appealed. So whoever would come in for Maurizio Sarri would at least get this summer. That's going to play a part, I think, in anyone's thinking.
Do you think the transfer ban might actually be a force for good for Chelsea? Because it'll sort of force them to use some of their younger players?
Would force them to keep Hudson-Odoi at least, I think.
Well, they can still sell players. I mean,
and Loftus-Cheek came on and did what Loftus-Cheek offered. I mean, the touch with which he set up his own pass to Hazard for that offside marginal was the touch of the game, and in a game of many decent touches, actually. But maybe that's the problem with Ruben Loftus-Cheek. In every game, I see him do something which I think, what a player, and then don't really see him do anything else.
Just a precedent on people refusing to go off, Jonathan Wilson tweeting, in November 1948, the Kispest manager, Bela Gutman, tried to take off the fullback, Mihaly Patti, at half-time for being too aggressive, even though that meant playing with 10 men for the rest of the game. Patti, encouraged by his captain, Puskas, stayed on. Only Wilson will know if any of that is true.
There was another one, which was in a League Cup final. I was actually at this, Manchester United Sheffield Wednesday 91, where Les Seeley had his knee cut open in a challenge, and Alex Ferguson wanted to take him off because he was so badly hurt, and Mad Les screamed. I mean, if I was at the other end of the pitch and you could hear Les refusing to go off in the days when there was an atmosphere at football grounds, and he stayed on, and then I don't think he played for a long time after that, and then played in the Cup Winners' Cup final with a bandage around his knee. And, you know, poor Les, no longer with us, but a total hero for that occasion.
You say in a time when there was an atmosphere at football grounds, there seemed to be an atmosphere at Old Trafford, I thought. Manchester United 0, Liverpool 0. I just thought the Manchester United fans really understood the situation that their team were under. Another game where they get injuries, a bit like PSG, and just sung for the whole game, John.
Well, Manchester United has that reputation of being a ground where the atmosphere is not great. The day trippers coming in from all over the world. But on its day, And against Liverpool, it can be, you know, a real cauldron of noise still, because Old Trafford is still one of the old style stadiums. It's just sort of been built on. But I suppose that speaks to the fact that the fans are behind the team in a way that they haven't been for, well, essentially the last 6 years, behind a manager who has unrivaled affection for being who he is and for turning the team around. And in adversity, the fans got behind a team. Now, why did those injuries happen? There was this theory that garlic is being used on the Manchester, on the Old Trafford pitch. Have you seen this?
What? No, this is interesting.
Yeah, I heard briefly about this. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
How much garlic?
They use garlic on the, for some sort of, I don't know, some sort of...
Keep vampires away?
Well, supposedly...
Pellegrini left City a long time ago, didn't he?
What,
Emery still had to come this
season. Yeah, true.
You remember the Old Trafford pitch was always quite bad. It had a bad reputation. When Manchester United failed to win the title, it is in 1992, the pitch was blamed that season. Oh. Actually, I think they perhaps weren't good enough. But they've taken lots of steps, and at one point they put worms into the pitch and all this type of thing. But the latest remedy is garlic. And it is said that because of this, if you're actually within smelling shot of the... of the ground, you can actually smell the garlic on the field. The pitch did look a bit dry, maybe because of the good weather recently, but it seemed to produce four injuries in that first half. In fact, five, including Marcus Rashford.
So here they go. Why do Manchester United use garlic on the Old Trafford pitch? It's on Sky. As they spray it on. You may have heard about tea bags to enhance your skin, or baking soda to clean the carpet. What about garlic to improve a football pitch? The root vegetable helps keep parasites from damaging the roots, and United, along with a number of other Premier League clubs, have been using the technique once a week for the last 5 years. So they can't really blame that on three injuries or four injuries happening in the first half. I mean,
maybe they overdid it this time.
Possibly.
We've all overdone the garlic. In this
we time. Have, absolutely. Well, they've just lost the garlic crush and just chucked it on whole. Klopp at full time while shaking Solskjaer's hand, Barry, said parental advisory, fucking hell, what a shit game. I actually quite enjoyed it.
I suppose it wasn't great, was it? I mean,
no, it wasn't great.
Neither game were great. I think because there was so much at stake added to the pot pass for the excitement, it's by any standards a draw at Old Trafford is a decent result, but I can't help but feel Liverpool left that one behind them. I think they should have won. And again, they're just not firing, and they're not playing very well at the moment. Still top of the table by a point, but if I was a Liverpool fan, I'd be concerned by recent performances, including that one.
There's a temptation to demand more of Klopp's side, having seen what we've seen in the past few seasons with how good Liverpool have been going forward. But it's worth remembering where exactly they ended up as well, because in the last two seasons, they've only made the top four on the final day. Last season, they were 25 points off the top of the table come the end of the season. The season before that, 17 points off the top of the table. And this has all come from Jurgen Klopp giving that little bit more defensively. He has had to sacrifice something. As exciting as it was to watch as a neutral beforehand, I think that this was a necessary step for him to take. And I think that the risks of what they would have lost yesterday, just symbolically, if they'd lost at Old Trafford going into the final games of the season, I think it was actually probably the right call from him.
But what you need then, if you're not pressing and the midfield aren't pressing, is you need the front three to really perform. And Mane sort of carried them recently, hasn't he? Firmino's had that virus, he got injured yesterday. Salah is not looking like... But Luke Shaw kept Salah very quiet and he played very well. But you need that front three to deliver, John.
Yeah, there was some stats about... Well, actually, this was the fifth draw played out by Manchester United and Liverpool in their last seven meetings. This should be the Old Firm derby of English football. You know, it's the two biggest clubs, yet it's almost always a poor game. And that's actually since Jurgen Klopp's come in. He's made that fixture even worse than it was before. But yeah, a Salah stat that I saw, 15.4% success rate in 50-50 challenges from Mo Salah. That's not good.
He doesn't want it enough.
No, and the one moment where he perhaps didn't want it enough, but Juan Mata was one of the players that actually went off injured. His final contribution to the game while playing on one leg was to run back and tackle Salah.
He was dispossessed 6 times. His only shot was that free kick, which was the only shot by any of the front three. They were disappointing. But how much credit do we give Manchester United, Archie? And how much do you think Solskjaer and the players learnt from the PSG game where they lost attacking players to injury, or they lost players to injury, but they didn't shut up shop, and this time they did?
Pogba had to do a different role after all those substitutions. I thought he took that on and he took that responsibility very well. I'm sure Graham Souness was very happy to see that as well. I think that there is something of a learning curve here for United as well. As Mark Chapman put it on Match of the Day too, football wasn't invented in 1992, but this is the best ever Premier League start in the first 10 games by any manager, points-wise. I think, drawing back to a point that John was making earlier about Solskjaer and the fans being on side, United have gone through a very necessary process, I think, post-Alex Ferguson, which was after the dynasty that you create. And that is very much the modern DNA of Manchester United. They've gone through his recommendation. They've gone through a top European coach in Louis van Gaal. They've gone through the coach who would guarantee you to win the Premier League. I think those were necessary steps to now see that actually somebody who they need is somebody who has Manchester United DNA as such, and somebody who really gets the club. And I think that the progression, and actually what Solskjaer did yesterday, I think, coming back to your question, it does show that they did learn something in terms of the way that they set up, because I actually think they boxed very cleverly. And in that second half, you would have said United the most likely side to win. And just one final point on Klopp.
Mm-hmm.
We want him to be gung-ho and that, but being that emotional and being the anti-Claude Puel that he is, it's lost him his last eight finals in a row. I think that he's having to compromise a little bit at the moment for him to get that success that is going to really put him amongst Liverpool greats or whatever.
Klopp is beginning to boil over a bit. There was a touchline row with Shaqiri before Shaqiri even came on.
He wasn't running enough.
Yeah. I've not liked what I've seen so far. And him and Henderson, no handshake when Henderson left the field. Right. So maybe
the cracks are starting to appear.
Exactly, yeah.
A friend of the pod, Elliot Rothwell, tweets, given Klopp said United's injuries ruined Liverpool's rhythm, what length should he go to ensure all opposition players are feeling healthy for 90 minutes?
It's an interesting point on top of his previous assertion that a decision that went in Liverpool's favour ended up costing them points in a match, because the ref was overcompensating.
I hear garlic's good for the
is that right?
Constitution. Yeah.
Burnley 2, Spurs 1. Barry, what did Mike Dean say to Maurizio Pochettino at the end of that game?
I've no idea, but I'd really love to know, and I hope it comes out at some point. I presume it probably will. But
the question is, what did Mike Dean say to Maurizio Pochettino to make him even angrier?
Mm. I mean, I've got this theory that Mike Dean is desperate to get into reality telly.
Even in this era when reality TV is sort of fading out a bit.
I think he's really keen to get on Strictly. You know, you can see that going, I used to point on the pitch and now I point on the dance floor. And
So what he'd do, Staying Alive?
With a card in each hand.
Bee Gees week, he'd be great. Then he might struggle. But you can just tell that if that had been another referee, Pochettino would have been angry. And if Pochettino was just angry about that corner decision, not really. It was very tight and they could still defend it. But you can just, I'm just sure Dean said something like, well, that's your title gone, mate, or something like that. And it was just a funny scene, wasn't it, with Pochettino's right-hand man.
Jesus. Both of them were just... Very uncharacteristic behaviour from them. So, yeah, it can't have been just the corner decision.
Well, Poch did his own Chelsea-style Politburo pullback from the situation almost straight away, though, didn't he? It's a long walk to the dressing room at Turf Moor, and by the time he got in there, he'd calmed down and thought, could have got myself in trouble there, and then was hugely apologetic. Which is good to see.
It is. Look, Spurs weren't good, were they? And I hate to use the phrase Spursy. This was a massive opportunity, though, the early kickoff. you know, Man City not playing in the league, Liverpool not playing till the next day. It was the same situation when they were home to Wolves. It was like, this is the win they need for everyone to go, well, hang on, they are, this is definitely on. And it just didn't happen, Archie.
I don't think they actually played too differently to how they played in the last few games and won, actually. The difference was Harry Kane came back, and actually the only quick bit of thinking, which, as Sean Dyche was saying, she probably shouldn't have been allowed anyway because it was taken about 9 yards up the touchline. That was the source of their goal on Saturday. So they're still having a really good season. I don't think you can talk and accuse this side of bottling it exactly. It was looking up in terms of the best ever Premier League seasons that you have. Spurs are ranked 21st in that table points-wise right now, and they're third in the division.
Yeah.
I think that you still have to value that, particularly in terms of what they've done transfer-wise. But, yeah,
it'll just, as someone who always Spurs my big team who win things, you just go, oh, were you serious? That's
Burnley
annoying.
Were very impressive, and they've been playing well. Ashley Barnes and Chris Wood bullied the Spurs defence. When Foyth had a bit of a mare, he wasn't able to handle them at all. And, you know, Burnley have had a rich vein of form. They've had a break of almost 2 weeks. And when they went on a similar break last February, they came back, drew their first game, and then won five in a row. So it's not a huge surprise to see them come back and do well in their first game back after, you know, recharging the batteries, warm weather training or whatever.
What is Sean Dyche's version of warm weather training? Like Cleethorpes or...
No, he took them to... I think it was either Spain or Portugal, but he took the entire squad and all his staff, and including the injured players, because he wanted everyone to feel included.
Yeah, Burnley unbeaten in 8 Premier League games. Their longest top flight run without defeat since a run of 9 in 1966, 1-5, drawn 3. Archie?
There was a great stat, sadly, from my perspective, that Tom Heaton, since coming back from injury, has gained more points this season than Fulham. 18 points was from Richard Jolly on Twitter.
It was Richard Jolly. It's always Richard Jolly.
Well, Southgate was there, wasn't he? And you think Heaton must be number 2 to Jordan Pickford now in the England reckoning. Harold says, watching Spurs Burnley, I realised that I imagine Max to look identical to Craig Paulson. I don't know if that's insulting to either of them, how far off the mark or how far off the mark I am. For reference, everyone else I have a Simpsons image of, particularly Barney, who is obviously Barney, Wilson is Mr. Smithers, and Barry is Moe in a Homerish body. How wrong am I? Just me and my wife were discussing on Friday night in bed whether we were boring or not, and I imagine Craig Paulson is boring. So perhaps it's quite accurate. But, you know, I may be doing Craig a massive disservice. But of all the referees, he's certainly not going to get on Strictly ahead of Mike Dean, is he?
You're actually the same age as Craig Paulson.
Am I?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen us in the same room? Has Craig Paulson been doing the pod for the last 2 years?
How old's Craig Paulson?
39, I presume.
Yes, yes. He's also got one of the dullest Wikipedia entries I've ever read.
Well, let's hear the Craig Paulson Wikipedia entry.
Craig Paulson, born 2nd of March 1979, is an English professional football referee who officiates primarily in the Premier League, having been promoted to the panel of select group referees in 2013, as well as in the Football League. Now, I think Craig might have written this himself.
Do you think? My Wikipedia has been more interesting at times. I was once in the BNP and going out with Louis Walsh at the same time. But neither of those are true. They may be true of Craig Paulson.
I think that might be true of Craig Paulson.
Yeah. That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start with the sacking of Claude Puel.
It's time to focus.
Well, I think that Democrats are going to have to contend with the fact that everything is about Donald Trump.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Richard says, Max, could you make Barry do the excited whoop when you plug the live show, please?
Ooh.
We don't even need to plug it because me, you, Bukowski and Squires have sold out Earth in Hackney. Apologies if you were thinking about coming, you're too late. And the message is, if you want to come to a live show, you've got to get in quick.
Yes, no pressure, Squires.
Well, are you going to say anything or just watch Squires?
I can't wait to see. He's complaining about me saying that he might not be funny in the person as he is when drawing cartoons, and because he thinks that is probably almost certainly true.
Be hard to be that funny, to be fair.
Yeah.
So if it goes really badly, David, don't worry. It's all right. We'll all still be alive the next day.
And we've sold out, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly right. We don't even need to turn up, do we? Leicester 1, Crystal Palace 4. The day after this game, Claude Puel was fired. Barry, you've spoken a lot about how interesting you found Claude Puel. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised he's been fired. I think if it hadn't been for the tragic helicopter accident which claimed the life of Leicester City's owner earlier this season, he probably would have gone a few months ago. I think personally he's been a victim of his own lack of charisma, because he's a very dull man. Himself and Unai Emery don't sell themselves very well, and while that might not be important in the cosmic scheme of things, it gives the fans a perception that perhaps the manager isn't trying as hard as he should. And Robert Huth was on Five Live yesterday and gave a very withering assessment of his qualities as a manager. Apparently, I don't think anyone in the Leicester dressing room is going to be too sad to see the back of him.
It was interesting, wasn't it, listening to Huth, because you felt like Huth was actually holding back.
Yes.
Even though it was still absolutely damning. Archie?
I think he's suffering from the very long shadow of Leicester City's Premier League winning campaign still, and indeed the amount of charisma that was there. And as I can now attest to myself, Claudio Ranieri isn't necessarily the best manager, but all the stars aligned at the time. And I think there are big characters to manage in that dressing room that he didn't manage to get a hold on, in the likes of Kasper Schmeichel and Jamie Vardy in particular. So I was talking.
Do you think it's just because Kasper Schmeichel wants to kick it as far as he can to Jamie Vardy? They're both upset that Puel doesn't want them to do that.
Probably. I think I was talking to a French journalist colleague of mine who was saying, I was like, okay, so is Puel in French? Is he any more entertaining? Is he renowned as? No, he's just as boring, was the answer I got back. So on the one hand, I do look a little bit at, do we fetishize this whole, you need to be a character, you need to have passion and show all that, because he's proven himself technically competent. The sides he's managed have not really been too close to the relegation battle before. He's got Southampton to the cup final as well. So
should have won it too.
Yes.
I think he's almost a victim of the culture we're in today as much as anything. But if you can't handle those personalities, the question I really ask now is, who comes in? Because where do you go with Leicester? You made this point yesterday on Talk Sport. What do you do if you are Leicester City when you have that great success behind you? Where can Leicester really go? In fact, the next guy who comes in is going to have a even more difficult job. Alan Shearer was saying, what a great job that Leicester is for the next year or so, maybe. But thereafter, trying to rebuild this club and where exactly do you go? I'm not so sure that this is quite such a tasty job right now, because you've got quite a rebuild, and whoever comes in next, you're going to be the guy who got rid of the title winning heroes.
Brendan Rodgers is odds on, John.
Well, yeah, and Brendan Rodgers, that talk's been around for quite a while. You think of fits for Leicester, and you also think of fits for Brendan Rodgers, who seems it's a little bored of life, maybe at Celtic. If his ambitions are in European football, then they've not been achieved up there. But I think I don't necessarily disagree with Archie, but I would say that there's a lot to work with there. And this is maybe one of the problems with Claude Puel, is that you look at the players that he's got to work with, the young players coming through, replacing that, should we call them Leicester's golden generation? But Ben Chilwell, James Maddison, Harvey Barnes. They've got Youri Tielemans, who I saw play against Tottenham a couple of weeks ago. Thought was excellent on his debut. There are talented players within that squad. And that's maybe one of the things that counted against Claude well, because there is that talent there. And yet they'd collected 1 point since New Year's Day.
And he played a weak inside in the FA Cup. And I know you've got to rotate and keep your squad happy. But that FA Cup is... I know United and City are still in it, but it sort of feels like it's a great chance for those sides that aren't going to get relegated. And
he almost won the wrong games, though. He won away at Chelsea. He beat Manchester City at home, but he fluffed the home games against the smaller sides.
And that point was against Liverpool. So, you know, they were... It shows that there were players there. There was talent there.
He helped bring them through, though, as much as anything.
Yes, maybe his legacy will be... a little stronger in the future.
Below the line, before Puel was fired, Heaven Airport made an excellent point. Claude Puel's English is excellent. It's his charisma that's lacking. So, genuine question. Instead of taking a translator into interviews, should he be taking a hype man instead to interject up every sentence?
The crocodile Fitch.
Have you seen him on the sidelines, though? He's screaming his way through the game. Like, you see this side of... If Claude, whispering Claude, just becomes this animal on the sideline. He's screaming his way through the game. And then as soon as he comes off the field, and it seems with his players as well, he's just, you know, this monotone.
The thing about Rodgers, though, I suspect Brendan's ego is sufficiently big for him to be keeping a very close eye on what's going on at Stamford Bridge. And he might be worried that if he takes the Leicester gig...
Chelsea would never go for him, would they?
I don't know. I think he might actually be a good choice.
But whether he's a good choice is a different question.
Well, yes. The transfer ban coming up, you know, he's good working with young players. I think he might be a good choice. I would imagine he thinks he'd be a very good choice. And so, that could throw a spanner in the works.
Forgotten he was there, wasn't he?
He used to work there.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that.
He used to coach... Roman Abramovich's son playing football.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was one of the...
Was he good, Abramovich Jr.?
Well, that is true, but that's one of the accusations made about Rodgers as a climber of the greasy pole, is that he was, you know, Roman asked him to coach his son playing football.
What, like one-on-one coaching?
Yeah.
Oh, right. I thought you meant in a...
Oh, really? What? Nothing to do with... Like, took him to the park and said, kick with your left foot.
Took him through, you know, this is, you know,
that's
head
so
down,
tragic,
knee over the
it?
Ball. Yeah.
How old was Abramovich Jr.?
I don't know. I'd have to look that up. But that is one of the backstories of Brendan's career, yeah.
Oh, that's tragic, isn't it? Fair play to Roy Hodgson, though. Oldest ever Premier League manager. The oldest I've found in my research. 2017, Alex Smith took charge of Falkirk, aged 77. And wow. Ivor Powell was still coaching Team Bath until he retired in 2010 at the age of 93. Powell played with Stanley Matthews as a record transfer fee of £17,500 in 1946. Awarded the MBE for services to sport in 2008. Even introduced to Italian spiritual leader Mahatma Gandhi while posted in India during World War II. So still plenty for Roy to accomplish.
There's plenty for Jonathan Wilson to write a book about that.
Absolutely. I should just let him know, shouldn't I? Ivor Powell, The Real Story by Jonathan Wilson, will be available on Amazon in about 2 years' time. Archie, can you be closer to the mic when I next talk to you? Great. Arsenal 2, Southampton 0 in the game that no one noticed was on Sunday. Arsenal jump into fourth above Man United after their draw. 10th of March, they meet at the Emirates. That could be huge, John, couldn't it?
It could, though. Manchester United do seem to do quite well against Arsenal quite a lot of the time. Good win for Arsenal. And... after that Bate Borisov game, Unai Emery's turned it around a little bit. I'd like to talk about Southampton.
Yeah, their defending was hilarious. It was almost as bad as Fulham's.
Well, they played okay in the game, apart from the defending. It's a cliche now about Southampton how the raw materials have been stripped bare. Ralf Hasenhüttl's Austrian Klopp came in, new manager bounce, and they're in exactly the same position as they were when they sacked Mark Hughes, and I think that they should probably bring Mark Hughes back right now.
West Ham 3, Fulham 1. Archie, how are you feeling? You're in trouble, aren't you? You done?
How long have I got?
You've got, Jonathan, how long's he got? 2 minutes? 2 minutes.
Fulham persisting with Ranieri makes zero sense right now because he's not going to stay long term. They're going down. He's not improved things defensively at all. He's not to blame for the entire situation. You have to go back to the transfer recruitment. I remember being in here with you buzzing about the new season because I thought that the club had learnt from its transfer mistakes of the past. I thought that they were finally on the same level as Slavisa Jokanović, having been at war with him with Craig Klein previously. Then out the club, they made these final signings last January before getting promoted of Alexander Mitrovic and Matt Target in particular were the two that really kicked Fulham onto promotion. It was like, okay, finally, they're buying the players to fit the manager's system. That did not happen in August. You started to see players who weren't being played because Jokanović didn't want them. It was that clear. We signed Alfie Mawson for a lot of money from Swansea when he had injury problems. That was an error. Zambo Anguissa, nowhere to be seen. 20 million plus bonus. Seri's been okay, but nothing more than okay.
So who was the one you mentioned?
20? Exactly. Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa.
And it cost how much?
20 million plus add-ons.
Wow.
So you can't... You look at the way that a side like Watford have shopped around, for example, and been a little bit clever. I think Fulham are afraid to admit that they're a smaller club, and that's holding the club back in on and off the pitch, for example, with the ticket prices. There's going to be a hashtag stop the greed protest in the coming weeks, by the looks of it, against the way that an average match day ticket price, even for a Class B game, is £45 at the least.
Those famously insurrectional Fulham fans as well.
Exactly, exactly. Behave. but you look at the way that things are going and, defensively you have Tim Ream, who I know is a byword for having a Tim Ream.
Yes.
is not a good...
He was your player of the year last season.
He was. He was really good. But what's gone under the radar a bit is that he had a real back problem at the end of last season and that's affected him. Dennis Odoi came in and was part of this 23-match unbeaten run last season, but was
Time
the
up.
Reserve. but was the reserve centre-back. So you've got that. And then if you're playing three goalkeepers in your first nine games... as well, that's not a great sign.
At the same time, you thought you should have a better defensive record. And Sessegnon was marking Diop. That is ludicrous, right? Even on a Saturday, I'd be like, that looks like that's a mismatch. I mean, I don't know if all the rest of the players are smaller than that, but that seems total madness.
That's part of the problem, is that the big characters from last season have been completely alienated. Tom Kearney's being stuck out on the right wing, which is nowhere near where he plays. The biggest problem with Ranieri is that there's no thought to any transition from what Jokanović was trying to do to Ranieri, where it is dilly-ding, hit it long. It's not very good at all. And the longer that Fulham wait, I want to see a West Brom situation, I would say, where Scott Parker, who's currently the assistant, would be brought in, at least get players back on side, get key dressing room characters like Kevin McDonald, for example, back on side and maybe get a little bit of momentum into the Championship season. Otherwise, I fear a Felix Magath consequence situation. That's it.
Adam says, has anyone ever been more giggly in a post-match presser than Mikel Antonio trying not to answer a question about Chicharito's handball goal being shown on the big screen?
Did you see that he later did his dance with Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville?
Yeah, I found it awkward.
I had problems with that myself, yeah.
I mean, are we having a sense of humour failure? Is it good to have no inhibitions?
I don't think Gary Neville's going to make it when he goes on Strictly.
No. But, you know, not being good at dancing is not the issue. We
just get up and dance.
Exactly, yeah. We shouldn't be so snotty about it, John.
Fair enough.
And
okay, accepted.
Listen, some of us may have danced on Sky before, on more than one occasion. Cardiff 1, Watford 5. Neil Warnock was livid, Barry, that they didn't get a penalty when they were 1-0 down. And he was absolutely spot on. It was a daft decision. Even still,
it was the Murphy twin, because I still can't remember which one's at what club, was clattered by Daryl Yanmat. Absolutely a penalty.
I'm saying Jacob.
Right, okay. Well, it was a penalty. Whichever Murphy it was that was clattered.
Even still, De La Feo doesn't score too many hat-tricks, does he? I mean, you say Southampton are really struggling, and we still think Cardiff have got a chance of staying up, but that is an energy-sapping defeat, isn't it?
definitely, especially after the previous week or the previous victory. Deulofeu, as you say, is a player that flickers only briefly, but he is very hugely talented. But he was given the freedom of Cardiff to score that hat trick and actually supply the assist for Troy Deeney's goal. I think even Neil Warnock knows that if you're going to complain about a penalty decision, which, you know, he's correct about, it doesn't really wash when you concede another four goals.
Yeah, at that, the goal Deeney scored was just a wonderful team goal, but Cardiff's defending was horrific.
I have to say, with Javi Gracia, I think he's a contender for manager of the season, surely, for the job that he's doing on that budget, for the football that Watford are playing as well. That fourth goal you mentioned, I think it was 30-plus passes or so before they scored that as well. So it's easier to come in when the fans so disliked Marco Silva come the end of that, and you don't have to show much loyalty or much class, I think, to be warm to after that. But
Cardiff's goal was one of the worst goals I've ever seen. Probably should only be worth a half. And the fact they even celebrated
Sol Bamba's celebration.
It was so good. It was Josh Murphy, by the way, of the Murphy twins, who was scythed down for that penalty. Okay. Newcastle 2, Huddersfield 0. Almiron looks good, doesn't he, Archie?
He does. I think when you're having to be hacked down like that so early on by any sort of opponent, I think it shows that the opposition fear you, and particularly the way that the whole of that Newcastle side was gelling together as well. Very good signs. Sean Longstaff had a very good game in the centre as well. Florian Lejeune at the back as well, in terms of the way he was opening the game up. Very positive signs. I don't think Newcastle are going to be in much trouble. And I would temper it a little bit and say, okay, this is a Huddersfield side that when you get a man sent off that early on, you're always going to dominate the game that little bit more, particularly when Huddersfield were trying to push up still. So a good start, but let's see what comes against Burnley.
Producer Jonathan writes, yeah, Almiron, Rondon and Perez could be a productive front three. Could also be a mariachi band.
Oh God, that's good.
But I mean, he's got a good point, doesn't he? They've got all the ingredients.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was so impressed with Almiron. It was his home debut. There's Newcastle fans already worship him. You can tell he got a standing ovation when he came off. He was very unlucky not to score. I was must confess, when I first heard he was a target for Newcastle, I'd never heard of him. Did a bit of research on him, saw a nice video on YouTube of him being very nice to a young fan at an airport, and you never know how MLS success is going to translate to a better quality league. And while a match between Newcastle and Huddersfield is never going to be of the highest quality, he was quite spectacularly good and very unlucky not to get a goal on his home debut.
Richard Jolly, another stat, 89 of the 92 Premier League and Football League clubs have won at least one game in all competitions since New Year's Day. The other three are Rotherham, Huddersfield and Leicester. Huddersfield are completely doomed, aren't they? But, you know, they'll have fun in the Football League again, or they won't. But you imagine they're being sensible, unlike perhaps Fulham.
The Football League's great. I can't wait to get back. You get to win games every other week. It's fun.
Bournemouth 1, Wolves 1, a tale of three penalties. Josh King hard and low. Josh King wide. Raul Jimenez waiting for the keeper. What's the best of those three? I mean, not missing. But where do you feel happier with your penalty taker? Ramming it in the bottom corner or being so cool as to watch the keeper?
Yeah, bottom corner. That's the classical way to do it, isn't it? But actually, talking of penalties, I know this is going back. Aspilicueta's penalty yesterday, that was one of the best I've seen as well. So, you know, where you just...
Oh, it was.
Where you're just
unbelievable.
Absolutely... The Pressman. The Kevin Pressman.
Yeah,
that's those are the best penalties.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Kevin Pressman's penalty, it is the great. Just go on YouTube. I mean, he basically takes a goal kick into the stanchion, doesn't he? That's what he does. He's just truly tremendous. In the Football League, very tight at the top of the Championship. Norwich twice coming back from behind for a 3-2 win over Bristol City, who were on a 7-game winning run. Kenny McLean with 2 for the Canaries. A huge win for Sheffield United, 1-0 at 4th placed West Brom, means they're second, 2 points behind Norwich, above Leeds on goal difference, who scraped past Bolton 2-1. Poor Ipswich bottom. They went down to 10 men after 25 minutes away at Wigan. They took the lead 7 minutes later and were ahead until the 91st minute when their former player Joe Garner scored an equaliser. At least he didn't lose. That's good. And Tom writes, how's this for shithousery from the Reading-Rotherham game on Saturday? Will Volks left a towel pitch side for a long throw before kickoff. Tyler Blackett nicked it while he was walking back and handed it to the groundsman leaving the pitch. Q Volks looking where he was sure he'd left a towel before the first throw-in completely flummoxed. League One, Luton's run of 6 successive wins was ended. They were held to a 1-1 draw by Coventry at Kenilworth Road on Sunday. They're still 5 points clear of second place Barnsley, who drew 0-0 at fourth place Portsmouth. Sunderland are third. They beat Bristol Rovers. Charlton and Doncaster make up the playoff spots in League One. League Two, Lincoln's first win in 5. Morecambe means they're still on top. Bury in second beat Paul Scholes Oldham 3-1. Third place Mansfield beat Forest Green. At the bottom, Notts County lost. Macclesfield drew. The stuttering Colin Calderwood Revolution, not helped by a 1-0 defeat at Yeovil, who themselves had lost the previous 5 games. Great. And just in case you're interested in the National League, Wrexham are top. Solihull Moors, managed by Tim Flowers, in second. Leighton Orient are third.
Salford City.
Yeah, what about them?
Blowing it.
Really?
They're on a horror run at the moment. The Gary Neville, Ryan Giggs and David Beckham. In fact, since David Beckham's ownership of the club has gone public, I think they've lost all of their games. Down in that division, they are the best funded team. Bought Adam Rooney from Aberdeen at the start of the season, which was controversial considering he was coming from the top division. They also took, disgracefully, Macclesfield's best midfielder, Danny Whitehead. And it's not working out for them.
Lost their last 4 and drew the 3 previous ones in all competitions.
Yeah, they're doing a sort of Chelsea under Sarri sort of thing. You know, big spending but not really getting there.
Presumably, supporters of all the other teams in the National League are very sad to see this happening.
Yes, they're, you know, it's just one of those things that, I mean, you see the Gary Nevilles of this world talk about how Manchester City bought success and then in another...
Yeah, but if your team buys success, it's fine. I mean, we can't be too po-faced about it. I mean, we all want... I want someone rich to come in, as long as they pass the fit and proper persons test.
I think Gary Neville passes that, to be
fair. Then I want someone to come into Cambridge and shower them with millions. I'm not going to be sort of puristly football about it.
Don't say that to a fan in Germany.
I won't. well, I might.
It's a hot,
you know?
It's a really hot topic right now, particularly because I think this week there's going to be a ruling on, a final ruling on Hanover and their attempts to break the rule with investors and the 50+1 and the 50+1 situation.
So is Gary Neville going to buy them? Or
I'd be interested to see whether that happens.
But when's football ever been a meritocracy? I mean, it never has.
Well, it certainly isn't in Germany.
No,
it's fan owned. The majority. That's why it's so different, and that's why clubs value the fact that they have that fans have their own say in how things are.
I understand that, but there are still clubs that have more money than other clubs and buy more expensive players.
Yes.
You just need some rich fans, right?
to an extent. You've got people who flunk the rule, like Bayer Leverkusen and Wolfsburg, for example, who are, workers' teams, which is a very loose interpretation there.
I can see there are teams that are sort of more ethically built, and it's nice.
Well, one-time hipster favourite, St. Pauli, for example, you know, they paint themselves as these sort of socialist beacon of a club, but then you visit their club shop and you soon find out they're not as socialist as they'd like to have you believe.
Barry, Fitbar, briefly, please.
Very briefly, in the wave of whataboutery that's sort of swooshed across Scotland in various sectarian rows that are going on, some Fitbar actually broke out. It's pretty much as you'd expect. Celtic beat Motherwell 4-1. There's a bit of controversy over one of the goals there because some Motherwell kid, an 18-year-old, refused to give the ball back after being put out of play for an injury. So Brendan Rodgers wasn't too happy about that. Rangers smashed Hamilton 5-0. Hearts and St Mirren drew. Wins also for Livingston and Aberdeen. And Hibs beat Dundee 4-2. And nothing too exciting.
In the Celtic game, there were three contested drop balls, Angus was in touch to tell me, which is something sadly lacking from football generally. So,
Is Scotland the only country where they actually contest drop balls?
I mean, I can't remember the last one. There's definitely one.
I saw one being dropped, I think it was between Scott Brown and some Rangers player. Yeah, but the ball might as well not have been there.
I was going to say, I'm all for drop balls in any league that Scott Brown is taking part in.
Yeah. No, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you and how are your water pipes?
Very well, thanks. And soda pipes.
Excellent news. Lionel Messi set a record, which is strange, isn't it? His 50th hat-trick of his career. They're unbeaten in 13. One of those, that volley was just glorious, wasn't it?
Well, all three of them were brilliant finishes, weren't they? And there's a little bit of me that one of the things about Messi is that this keeps happening. And so you get Messi scores a brilliant hat-trick, all three brilliant goals. He provides a really lovely assist for the fourth. They beat Sevilla 4-2, which basically means... Well, I say basically means we don't know this for sure, but you know, it puts him in a very, very strong position to win the league, a league which basically he's won on his own, and it feels like it's not a big deal.
Yeah,
and that's kind of Messi in a nutshell, really. And he was just brilliant. It was really important, I think, for Barcelona as well, because they come off the back of a run of pretty disappointing results and not scoring a lot of goals. I think the last four games, they'd only scored one, which was a penalty, which Messi scored against Valladolid, having then missed a penalty. Then missed a penalty later on in the game. Of course, they had the draw with Real Madrid in the cup. They drew with Lyon, having missed loads and loads of chances. So it did kind of feel like they need it in the build-up to a week, of course, in which they played Real Madrid in the Copa del Rey on Wednesday night and then Real Madrid in the league on Saturday.
Which was your favourite of his 50 hat-tricks, Sid? Do you have a favourite?
Well, I think it's the obvious thing to do is to go for the first one. March 2007. This is a time when there might still be a slight doubt about whether he's going to be absolutely amazing. And he scores a hat-trick against Real Madrid in the Clásico, and he was absolutely extraordinary. And at that stage as well, I mean, he was a different player to the one he is now, perhaps less control, but there was kind of an excitement in the way that he ran at people. And you could see then that, poof, this guy is going to be absolutely amazing.
Real won 2-1 last night. Both goals were penalties, weren't they? The second one...
Have you seen it? It's unbelievable.
Right. We were watching it. Just talk us through it. And the fact that VAR said it's still a penalty, I just can't imagine. What is the, who's in the Spanish VAR room? Is it just sort of six old men going, oh, the VAR's gone, someone get it, yeah, let's carry on with our game of cribbage or whatever.
There's a bloke under the desk with some kind of insulating tape desperately trying to reconnect the cables. For those who haven't seen it, it's Casemiro coming towards the ball in the area. Defender swings, a great big wild swing. I mean, you know, had he made contact, it really would have been a terrible foul. His foot flies past the side of Casemiro's leg, doesn't make contact, or if it does, maybe brushes past his shin pad. And Casemiro takes off. And he takes off and he flies through the air and he hits the floor and the referee points to the penalty spot and you think, oh wow, I mean the way that he fell, you could see that at the very least he'd exaggerated this. As it turns out, he's completely invented it. You watch the replay and you think, well, there's no way he's going to give this now, because they'll watch the replay and they'll give it, and they do give it. One of the arguments that's been put forward on this is that there's something about the protocol, the way that the VAR is used, and in theory at least, the VAR is only there for absolutely clear-cut decisions. Now, you would look at this and say, well, this is an absolutely clear-cut decision, and I would be entirely in agreement with you. The theory is that if there is a slight touch, then it becomes the referee's interpretation as whether that touch is sufficient to count as a foul and sufficient to have, if you like, brought the player to the ground, to have stopped the player continuing. What's baffling is that they saw that and didn't say, at the very least, look, go and have a look at it. You know, go and have a look and see, because it's funny. It's so bad it's funny. Almost as funny, by the way, was the reaction of Emilio Butragueño after the game, which is institutional director, who said, we never talk about referees. This is the club that spent the last 3 or 4 weeks talking about referees quite a lot.
Bale didn't celebrate. He shrugged off Lucas Vazquez. What should I read into that?
Well, I think you read into that Bale, who also, of course, celebrated quite angrily when he scored against Atletico Madrid in the derby, I think you read into that he feels under pressure, that he feels like he should be playing and should be starting. But I think not only that, but in the last couple of weeks, he's been attacked quite a lot in the media. And two players, Marcelo and Thibaut Courtois, have said things that really haven't helped him. So Thibaut Courtois said, and this is the guy we call the golfer. He didn't want to come to dinner. He said it was too late for him. He was going to bed. And as we talked about before, you know, of all the kind of accusations made against the footballer, being a golf player and going to bed earlier, not the most heinous crime that you know, you can imagine. But this has been held against him. You know, this is a guy who doesn't integrate, doesn't speak Spanish. Marcelo had said, look, I sit next to him in the dressing room, but we don't really talk. So with all of this happening, with that sense that, you know, there hasn't been support, that sense that he's been kind of under attack, that he's not playing, he's not happy about that, I think, not necessarily justifying it, but I think it's not that surprising, perhaps, that his mentality when he scores, like, well, so do you. Where were you? It's all well and good coming to me when I score, but where were you when perhaps someone could have come out and said publicly, you know, something in defence of Gareth Bale?
Sid, has there been any coverage of Kepa's mutinous behaviour in the Carabao Cup final in Spain?
Yeah, absolutely loads. It's caused a lot of noise here, with lots of very differing opinions. But the majority of them, I think, are fundamentally, wow, you cannot really allow a player to get away with this. And so although he's Spanish, that hasn't meant that there's been, if you like, kind of a surge of people trying to defend him. I think most people are genuinely pretty shocked by it.
We had an email from NJK reacting to Jonathan Wilson saying that Spanish managers sound boring in English. He says, following on from Wilson's observation in the Premier League, it ought to be pointed out that the interface works both ways. I'm sure Sid will confirm that listening to either Toshak and especially the ubiquitous Michael Robinson can be a real mind bender. Is that fair? I mean, I suppose you're English, so I don't know how you hear them in Spanish.
What you mean in terms of the way they speak, the accent and so on?
So I think Emery's sounding sort of quite sort of monotone, a bit like Claude Puel.
Well, obviously, I mean, if you have a limitation to how well you can express yourself, I suppose it's natural that you'll sound less expressive. But actually, in the case of Michael Robinson is someone who's built an extraordinary broadcasting career in Spain, very, very well liked. And part of his charm, in theory at least, was this failure to grasp Spanish perfectly. Well, actually, Spanish is very, very good, but there is a clear English accent. So much so that Robinson tells the story that he went away at the end of the season, that one of his bosses basically said to him, listen, go away on holiday, but don't go on holiday in Spain. I want you to come back speaking worse Spanish. And there was this kind of sense that part of the charm was this touch of Englishness. So much so that, for example, as you can imagine, as someone who works in the media here in Spain, people have occasionally suggested to me that one of the things that might make it work when I work on Spanish media is the fact that I'm English. That gives you something perhaps a little different. Now, I don't know actually whether that is always entirely positive, and certainly I've had times when Spaniards have had a go at me because of the kind of the Englishness of the way that I speak Spanish. Toshak is a slightly different case. Toshak is very famous in Spain, not just for the way that he speaks, which is considerably worse than Robinson. And as I say, Michael's very, very well liked and expresses himself, I think, really very well indeed. Toshak is famous in Spain for having introduced English idioms into the Spanish language. So things like water off a duck's back, the league is our bread and butter, six of one and a half a dozen of the other, these kind of phrases, which no one in Spain had heard before. Toshak introduced them to the extent that people now know them. Now, there's two very famous ones with Toshak. Toshak used to talk about players running around with their heads cut off, like chickens with their heads cut off. And that became a kind of a Toshakism, which got taken on in Spain. And the very, very famous one was when he was Real Madrid manager. He criticised his goalkeeper at the time. I think it was Pizarri, an Argentinian he had in goal, for a mistake that he made. And he was asked by the club's president, Lorenzo Sanz, to take it back, to apologise for publicly criticising his goalkeeper. Toshak said, there will be pigs flying over the Bernabeu before I apologise this. Now, flying pigs is a phrase that doesn't exist in Spanish. And Toshak introduced it into Spanish. And this caused an enormous stir. not least because there was this sort of implication, sort of hidden in the background, in the way that it was understood and the way that it was kind of interpreted, that is he somewhere along the line calling his president a pig? Is there some element that there's some sort of kind of porcine attack here going on from Toshack? And I remember in Marca, the big selling newspaper, the best-selling newspaper in Spain, a sports paper, having a cartoon picture on its cover the next day, a cartoon of the Bernabeu with a cartoon pig, pink and smiling with wings flying over the Bernabeu. Toshack got sacked for it.
And we know all the pigs end up in your garage, Sid, don't we?
So,
thanks for your time, as always.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. From Spain, we'll go to Italy and get a roundup from Serie A from Paolo Bandini.
So lots of goals in the big Serie A game this week, but also an awful lot of sitting around waiting for officials to make decisions. Fiorentina drew 3-3 at home to Inter, coming back from 3-1 down. And honestly, it was a really eventful game. It was fun. You had an own goal, you had two penalties, the quickest goal in Serie A since Opta started keeping records, and also the latest goal in Serie A since they started keeping those records. Yet at full time, you still had the Fiorentina manager, Stefano Pioli, coming out and saying, "We played little and watched a lot of VAR." We started with a roughly 3-minute delay after Inter's equalised to make it 1-1. It's only 5 minutes into the match, by the way. They'd conceded from an own goal almost immediately. That was before officials could confirm there had been no offside in the build-up. Subsequent to that, we had three huge decisions in the second half that went to the video ref. First, there was a handball against Fiorentina, which the referee missed in real time, and then gave after he went to take a second look at the pitch side screen. Ivan Perisic scored the penalty, which made it 3-1, and then Fiorentina thought they'd pulled one back about 10 minutes later through Cristiano Biraghi. That goal was eventually disallowed after a pitch side review because of a foul in the build-up. Again, the correct decision, but between that and the penalty, you can imagine the Fiorentina fans are getting pretty cheesed off. So they then do get a goal back with an absolutely stonking free kick from Luis Murillo, one of the best I've seen in a while, well worth checking out. And in the 96th minute, and you can see just from that how much injury time they've had to add on from all these VAR reviews, in the 96th minute they win a penalty. Only one look at the replays and it's as plain as day that Federico Chiesa's cross only hit Danilo D'Ambrosio in the chest, though nowhere near his arm. So everyone expects, at least everyone watching on TV expects this to be overturned on review. And by the way, Chiesa might have committed a foul in the build-up as well. So he goes to have a look at the screen. Again, we lose several minutes and comes back and says, "No, I'm still giving the penalty." So penalty Fiorentina finally gets taken. Jordan Veretout scores that in what is now the 101st minute. Absolutely extraordinary game. Extraordinary finish. Nothing else quite to match that elsewhere in Serie A this week. Juventus, who needed a reaction after their defeat to Atletico Madrid, instead produced a really drab 1-0 win away to Bologna, in which they had less than 50% of the ball and I think one third as many shots as Bologna did. So very unimpressive from them, but still they did win and they stay 13 points ahead of Napoli, who were more impressive in beating Parma 4-0 ahead of their head-to-head at the top of the table next week.
Thank you, Paolo. To Germany now. And not from Lucas Podolski's kebab shop, but right in front of me, Archie. How was it yesterday? Big game, Leverkusen Dortmund in Dortmund.
Really big because Dortmund hadn't won any of their last five games in the league and ended that against the man who ended their title dreams last season. But he was in the Dortmund hot seat at the time, Peter Bosch. That is Jadon Sancho. With another big performance, a goal and an assist. Still some way in terms of his overall performance to go, but for his age and what he's delivering right now, it's outstanding. That was big because Bayern had drawn level with Dortmund on points on the Saturday. Coach, President Uli Hoeneß even had said on the Sunday morning that Bayern were now leading the table as well. So that added some more oil to the fire as such. Bayern didn't play very well in their 1-0 win over Hertha. No real change there. The biggest headline off the back of that was Rafinha, their right back, coming out in the press after saying that coach Niko Kovac wasn't being correct to him in the same way that predecessors like Jupp Heynckes, Carlo Ancelotti and Pep Guardiola have given him time. That's important because ahead of the Liverpool game, Joshua Kimmich is already out suspended. So he is, in theory, going to need Rafinha. So another sign of it cracking a little bit behind the scenes at Bayern, but still the most exciting title race that we've had in ages.
Who do you think's going to win it?
Dortmund.
Is that your heart or your head?
It would be nice for a little bit of change,
yeah.
As much as anything, but there's something about Bayern off the pitch keep shooting themselves in the foot. I wouldn't have said what Hoeneß said in terms of why give your rivals, who were already looking pretty nervous without Marco Reus, without Lukas Piszczek on Sunday, why give them that sort of motivation? And I think that Dortmund are going to go out of the Champions League with Bayern. Still see where that goes. But Marco Reus is back in training as of today. I think that'll make the key difference.
Mm. I suppose in the same way that it might be good for Liverpool to go out of the Champions League to Bayern, it might be good for Dortmund. And look, they're already 3-0 down, right?
Sure.
It might be good for them to go out.
I think it would, particularly in terms of Marco Reus's workload and what he can do in terms of playing three games a week. He struggles with that. So yeah, there's one other thing I should mention, which is Reece Oxford. He was sent off in Augsburg's 5-1 defeat away at Freiburg. I don't think Reece Oxford quite realises the club that he's walked into here, because there has been quite a lot which has been crackling away at Augsburg. I think one thing that you'll like in particular. So Jens Lehmann has become assistant coach in the past few weeks. You might have heard about that. No. Good. But the only reason why Reece Oxford was actually signed by Augsburg in the first place was because of their centre-back Martin Hinteregger said after a 2-0 defeat away at Gladbach that he could not say anything positive or negative about the coach, Manuel Baum, and was promptly shipped out 3 days later. In came Oxford. But real problems at that club, which used to be a byword for stability, you look at their forward, Kayubi, who is quite the character. He failed to return from holiday in January from Brazil. Not the first time that he's done that. And then the first time that he was seen back in Augsburg was in the disco and was caught by a fan who took a picture of him. Kayubi has also, he was fined €22,500 previously for not paying a train ticket.
How much?
€22,500.
It's a bit steep.
He was coming back from Oktoberfest, but the way that they do the fine is because it's done on what you earn per month.
Okay.
So yeah, he also got chucked out of his flat for playing his music too loud and then was sacked by the club recently. Well, so he wanted to move away and he got his move. So yeah.
In France, Portlander writes, I like any episode where Max says Guingamp. A big result for bottom of the table, Guingamp. They beat Angers 1-0 for their first win in six, just 4 points away from safety now. Second place Lille drew their second game in a row, while PSG won again, now 17 points clear at the top. In the big game last night, Monaco moved up to 16th with a 2-0 win over third place Lyon. Memphis Depay missing a late penalty for the losing side. That's three wins and a draw in Jardim's four league games since he took charge of Monaco again. The Jardim bounce is a pretty impressive one after Thierry Henry. There's a full round of Premier League fixtures this week, which we'll review on Thursday, obviously. Cardiff, Everton, Huddersfield, Wolves, Leicester, Brighton, Newcastle, Burnley on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Arsenal, Bournemouth, Chelsea, Spurs, who'll be in goal for Chelsea. Palace, Manchester United, Liverpool, Watford, Man City, West Ham and Southampton, Fulham. A couple of things to finish on. One was a great tweet from Patrick Bamford. There's a parody Bamford that said, thank you for all my messages of support and encouragement. Going to unwind now with an hour of cello in the conservatory while the Dauphinois potatoes cook. Hashtag LUFC, hashtag MOT. The real Patrick Bamford quoted the tweet to say, I favour the violin, actually, old chap. I personally find the cello far too monotonous. And we'll finish with an email from Daniel Osborne. Thanks for getting in touch, Daniel. Max and the team, I just wanted to say thank you. He says it in inverted commas for the entertainment during what was been a pretty rubbish time for him over the past few months. Not a problem. He says, I'd like to ask if you feel as I do in this is the year for reluctantly liking the teams you know intrinsically you should hate. Leeds are hilarious and great to watch with Bielsa. Man United have suddenly become endearing with the chirpy-faced Solskjaer and everyone playing for them generally enjoying life and sticking a finger up to their former tormentor. Even Liverpool continue to be great to watch and Klopp still charms. Who can we hate now? Please help. It's a very good question. Who do you currently hate, Barry?
I don't hate anyone.
Should we arbitrarily pick one? I mean, we picked Watford early in the season for no reason, but I quite like Troy Deeney. Quite like Etienne Capoue and Ben Foster as well.
Let's go for Bournemouth. Really inoffensive team with a nice manager.
You can't
let's hate Bournemouth.
You can't hate Eddie Howe.
No.
Can you?
It's not really going off that far off the beaten track, but I got annoyed yesterday when Pep Guardiola talked about how the fact that Manchester City have won two titles, including the Charity Shield, or Community Shield, as he called it. You know, obviously it's the Charity Shield. I'm not having that.
Okay, well, let's hate Pep, shall we?
Yeah.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Archie.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.